Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Kate Brown returns, talking more about Plutopia. That word is a combination of plutonium and utopia. So you can imagine how well it all turned out. I hope you'll stay tuned. Historian Kate Brown studied two utopian towns. They were consumer paradises, built to keep workers happy, contented, loyal, and unquestioning. The two utopias were built in the 1940s, and they are remarkably alike. The one was built by Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union, and the other was built by DuPont and General Electric in Washington State, near Hanford. Their town is named Ozorsk. Ours is named Richland. These are utopian factory towns, and the factories made plutonium for nuclear bombs. What DuPont and GE and Joe Stalin didn't tell these happy workers is that the factories were horribly polluting the region with radioactivity, and the workers would be debilitated and die young of cancer and other diseases. And the workers would have children, and also grandchildren, with severe birth defects. So would many of the farmers and the other inhabitants of the whole region. Richland was full of nuclear families, all right. Kate Brown has done a very nice job of first-hand investigative research, both here and in Russia. And she talks very well about what she discovered. It's good history, but it's even more than that. Brown also tries to show that Richland, Washington is a metaphor for our modern American consumer culture, where the comforts and pleasures of our consumer lifestyle, some of them still provided by General Electric and DuPont, where the comforts and pleasures blind us to the out-of-control death and destruction that this infernal system is producing, including our own death and destruction. Climate change? What, me worry? Brown's talk triggered a few odd memories in me. Ich bin auch ein Berliner, John F. Kennedy famously said, mangling the German idiom just a little. I too am a Berliner. And we might well say, wir sind auch Plutopianen. We too are Plutopians. In Richland and in Ozorsk both, the plutonium workers were so delighted with their fantastic standard of living, they did everything they could not to notice increasingly obvious signs of serious problems all around. Did everything they could not to notice that Richland was both a utopia and a death camp. Same story in Ozorsk. One last thought. That good book and wonderful movie, Dr. Strangelove, had a subtitle. The full thing was Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. That's Richland and Ozorsk, and maybe here too. Well, we'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when. And in the meantime, with part two of her talk on Plutopia, here is Kate Brown.
For many residents who came from hardscrabble provincial towns in the Soviet Union or the USSR, residency in Ozorsk or in Richland was akin to winning the golden ticket. It meant a person had arrived in the kind of material comfort and prosperity that few had expected in their lifetimes. Ralph Myrick remembered his childhood in a New Mexico company mining town of packed clay and slag heaps. And when DuPont settled his family into this two-bedroom prefab, his mother broke down in tears of joy. She had never lived in a place so new, so clean, with utilities and plumbing. She had never lived in a place so affordable. Ralph's father hadn't finished high school, and Ralph said his father worried a lot. He worried that the plant would close after the war. He worried that At some point, the supply of plutonium would be satiated and the plant would close. He worried that his children would say something, or his wife or he would say something, and he would lose his job at the plant. And everybody knew if you lost your job at the plant, you had a month to move out of town. And Ralph knew that nowhere else with his skills and his education could he live so well as in Richland. Now, in the Soviet Union, the contrast between life in the closed city and life outside was so great that residents used gulag slang. They called the outside world the big world. And it wasn't difficult to lose your place in the socialist paradise either. If somebody drank too much, slept with other men's wife, they took it up in party meetings and threatened people with eviction. If your kid dressed like Elvis Presley, listened to the Voice of America, they would be sent out to a boarding school outside of the town, never to return. There was a big explosion in 1957 in this town, and people got nervous. They saw the fallout going, and they quit their jobs in droves. Several thousand people quit their job. But I found that after a couple of months, letters started streaming in saying, "I was stupid. Please take me back. I can't live out here in the big world." So I think that tells you that sort of these places' charm was so arresting and so seductive that people chose to remain in this Eden even when they realized or suspected they were putting their health at risk. So what I'm trying to say is it took a village or maybe a small city to produce the few kilograms of plutonium necessary for a nuclear bomb. And these cities were prize-winning cities. Richland won prizes for planning and housing and educational achievement. And it really led society in charting out post-war American suburbia. Oziorsk also won prizes for creating what the Soviets had been trying to produce since the 30s, which was a socialist city, a prize-winning kind of city that people could live in communism and prosperity and happiness. But the tranquil prosperity of these places sort of belied the fact that they were fronts in an unannounced Cold War that was going on, and that they were primary targets. It also overlooks the fact that all the while these people were enjoying these places, scientists were quietly contaminating the surrounding environment with millions of curies of radioactive waste. And I want to tell you a little bit about plutonium production because it's the messiest stop on the assembly line for nuclear weapons. A few kilograms of plutonium requires 100 tons of uranium and produces hundreds of thousands of gallons of radioactive waste. From 1948 to 1993, the Mayak and Hanford plants each dumped radioactive waste into the ground, the rivers, the airstreams, as part of the normal operating order. Because the military controlled these plants, knowledge of this dumping was not known by the public, nor were all research and health programs at the plant were pretty much sequestered away. This knowledge did not reach the public, neither in the dictatorial Soviet Union or in the democratic United States. In Richland, medical researchers suppressed evidence that local milk, river fish, sheep in the pastures, and sage in the front lawn registered alarming levels of radiation. They did their research secretly at times. Scientists dressed up as cowboys and went out and tested the thyroids of sheep. They wrote in classified documents that alerting residents to these problems would cause undue alarm and mass hysteria. DuPont set up a safety exhibit to promote an image of well-being and care. And you could go to these safety exhibits. You still can go. And there's lots of bathing beauties and door prizes. In Oziorsk, they took security even farther. They removed the plant and the city from the map. Offer you to try to find it. They banned the words radiation and plutonium, and workers had to guess that they were making nuclear weapons. So what's the effect of living on a radiated landscape and working in plants that were contaminated? It was really the first workers who got sick. And this is the Tcha River. In 1949 in Russia, they ran out of underground tanks to store highly radioactive waste. And so rather than stop production, they decided that we'll just dump it in the river. They did that. They dumped from 1949 to 1951 3.2 million curies of waste into the river. And downstream, 28,000 people were living, drinking from that river, washing with it, bathing in it, and fishing in it. And I'll get back to this river in a bit. Now, the first people to get sick at the plant were workers, or the first people in general to get sick were workers, and some died, and their deaths were attributed to natural causes. And I found, strangely enough, in the Hanford records, two autopsies, twice. I found two autopsies of one man, and I wondered about that. And one case, a 1952 case, there was a guy who, by the name of Ernst Johnson, he was working at the plant. He was a janitor. He was 45 years old, and he didn't feel well at work, and he went home, laid down on the couch, and died. His wife called the GE-run hospital, and the GE-paid doctor comes over and says, I'll do an autopsy. And the autopsy report says that the man died of an aneurysm. But the wife was kind of suspicious. She had seen on the corpse burns on her husband's arms. The doctor said, I don't know what those were about. Some co-workers came by and said, your husband got dosed at work. We saw it. And then the FBI was following her around town wherever she went. So as she was returning to Chicago for the funeral, and she took the body with her, she dropped the body off at the Cook County coroner and said, what do you think my husband died of? The second autopsy report by the coroner said that this man died of radiation poisoning. You can see the burns on the arms. You can see the damage to the heart. And he said, some important evidence from the body is missing, meaning organs had been removed and put somewhere else. Now, soon after that, in the archive, is a correspondence between this coroner and the Cook County coroner and GE lawyers who quickly flew to Chicago to try to get this coroner to redact and retract his autopsy. He refused to do that, so the GE lawyers went to the Washington State Labor Board in Olympia and got them to redact all information about radiation from this man's autopsy. The wife never got compensation, and to this day, Hanford says that they have no fatalities due to radiation incidents in the whole history of the plant. Now, in the Soviet Union, and these are doctors at the Soviet plant, the plants were built in haste and parsimony by hungry prisoners, and many buildings were really poorly designed for this kind of work. There was no money in the first years for rubber gloves, rubber boots for workers. In one lab, there were not even enough stools, so workers sat on wooden boxes filled with radioactive waste. Doctors had no idea of the kind of doses that their workers were getting because that was classified information, so the doctors were sort of working blindly. And so they learned to study the bodies of their patients, and they studied the blood cells, and they got so they could detect when a person was about to have what they called chronic radiation syndrome, which is a syndrome only found in the Russian Urals so far, which is from long-term exposure to low doses of radiation. And the symptoms are kind of an early radiation aging, organ failure, severe joint pains, chronic fatigue, anemia, diabetes, and other immune disorders. Now, several dozen women who worked at the radiochemical plant came down with this chronic radiation syndrome in the early 50s, and they were young women who had been given a clean bill of health in their 20s when they signed in on the plant. 5 years later, they're creeping around, barely able to move, and so they started to treat them and study them, and that's when they came up with this diagnosis. These young women died before they turned 30, and about 23% of the first plant workers were diagnosed with this chronic radiation syndrome. And this got the Soviets really nervous because they needed these trained workers. They were rare, they were valuable, they knew secrets, and they didn't want them going out somewhere and being an invalid. So they started to care for their workers. And one way to care for their workers was to, whenever there was a particularly dirty job at the plant, a spill to clean up, a cracked pipe that was dripping radioactive fluid, some construction work to do on contaminated ground with smokestacks going over it, they called in prisoners and soldiers. These people didn't have to be monitored. They didn't have to wear radiation badges. There was no, as temporary workers, there was no limitation on how much radiation they could get. They worked temporarily. They worked for a couple of years and then moved on, taking with them all kinds of radiation that they had ingested and any subsequent health problems. So therefore, the plant workers look healthier than they really indeed would have been. That it becomes sort of a, because of these temporary workers living in these staging grounds who are never considered nuclear workers, creates this picture of a healthy pink plutonium workforce, and the cities themselves especially. Now, this was just a mirage, but it was a useful mirage because people really believed in the safety of their plants. In fact, beyond a few isolated cases and some rumors about glowing in the dark and impotency, there were almost no social movements in either of these places until the 1980s. I found a couple of KGB agents who were whistleblowers in the 60s, but that was it. And that was kind of strange, I thought. And even after Chernobyl and the release of a great deal of documents about both Hanford and Mayak, the residents of these towns still fought against acknowledging the connection between the plutonium plants and any local health problems. And I wondered about that too. In both cities, these residents counted up the number of PhDs, and they were very proud of their education. But so why did they agree to live in ignorance for so long? Soviet residents had no electoral politics, no independent media, but the residents of Richland lived in a thriving democracy. Why did the famed checks and balances fail so that a disaster surpassing Chernobyl occurred in America's heartland? And I think the answer to this question lies in these plutopian towns themselves. They were so prosperous, so solicitous, so good at simulating the functions of a participatory society that they proved to be successful incubators of loyalty, patriotism, and a blind faith in authority. And these successful towns also gave the local leaders a lot of credibility. The orderly, universal well-being of family-centered Oziorsk and Richland, where the average age was 26, there were no indigent, no elderly, no unemployed, no crime, gave people a sense of superiority and of safety. And the Plutopia residents enumerated their superiority in a lot of different ways. They counted up their higher birth rates, longer life expectancies, higher average incomes and educational levels. They counted how many appliances they had, how they had larger living space and ate more milk and potatoes and dairy products. And they saw these indicators as validation of their towns and of their leaders and of their community's safety. And in some ways, their superior consuming status did keep these people safer. Rather than having to live off the radiated landscape, as did neighboring farmers, people in Richland and Oziorsk purchased their goods from places that came from far away. The milk specifically came from Minnesota to supply Richland. They drank water that was monitored, and the air was monitored too. In the Soviet Union, gynecologists even performed prophylactic abortions if a fetus looked kind of funny. And so that made the birth rate and the infant mortality rate look better than it might have been otherwise. So the assertions that Plutopia residents was healthier were in fact true because they were younger, more affluent, and had far better health care, but also because as modern consumers, they did not live off the radioactive landscape. And they would say things like, you know, relativize things, the plutonium plant is safer than driving your family car or using your home appliances. Now, in contrast, downstream from the Mayak plant, villagers lived on the radioactive T'cha River. They bathed in it and watered their crops and cooked with it. And in 1951, plant scientists finally went down and took some readings, and they determined that everyone and everything was dangerously radioactive. They actually stepped away from the children that they monitored because these children were so radioactive. They issued a ban on using the river and told the villagers they could not drink from it or go anywhere near it. But that was impossible because they had no wells. And so the villagers continued to go and draw water from the T'cha River. They also had nothing else to eat other than their own homegrown crops. As the years went by, people in the downstream villages fell ill with cancers, leukemias, thyroid tumors, infertility, and heart diseases. And their children suffered, too, from an uncommonly high number of birth defects. Here's if you go around this area and people are selling food on the roadside, all you had to do was put your Geiger counter there. Here I am, nervously trying to avoid eating a homegrown meal. The boy in the back is about 13, and he had a vocabulary of about 60 words. The next photo I'm going to show you is from a warehouse in Chelyabinsk that was part of the medical research facility where they were testing. They basically turned this village, Muslumovo, on the T'cha River into a natural experiment where they followed medically the three generations of residents on this river to see. They tested their blood every year and they took medical exams. And they also kept a storehouse of babies that didn't turn out. And there's about, I don't know, 500 or 600 of these babies in jars in the one room that I saw. So I'm going to get rid of that photo. Now, the illnesses in eastern Washington were similar in a way. And I would hear the same kinds of stories about these sort of vague complaints that ran through generations. And in fact, I just had dinner with a couple of people tonight, and they told me about similar kinds of problems that ran through generations. And then earlier today, I was interviewed by a reporter who grew up in Spokane, and he told me about his entire family riddled with cancers and birth defects, just by the by. I don't know what that is about, but to me, as I worked on this project, the fact that these same kinds of complaints are occurring across the globe in two different kinds of communities that are not in communion with each other was striking. Now, after 1986, when Chernobyl blew the lid off these places, these local farmers started to pop up and say, we're sick. We're sick, we think, from these plants. And the officials and scientists in both the Soviet Union, Russia at that point, and the United States said that these people were not sick from the plants, that they were sick because they drank too much, they were inbred, they had poor diets, or they just had radiophobia. They just attributed everything to radiation. They said they didn't have chronic radiation syndrome, but they were just chronic welfare cases looking for a handout. And it was easy to discredit the poor farming neighbors of the plutonium plants. The residents of Richland, Azurisk, had long viewed their poor farming neighbors with scorn and condescension. And they saw themselves as the chosen people. And if you didn't make it the grade in the plutonium city, it's because you weren't good enough. So these spatial practices that were set up, the staging grounds and the special cities, appeared to make the natural order look natural. But in fact, they were sort of created, manufactured spatial zones that were set up and then helped make this plutonium disaster invisible in many ways. Now, in Richland in the 1950s, big crowds gathered to see Ronald Reagan sponsor and host the GE Theater. And Reagan demonstrated the total new electric kitchen. And he transmitted the GE-endorsed message that consumer freedom was the cornerstone of democracy. And in Richland, where residents had given up most of their political freedoms, but had a great deal of buying power with all their extra wages, this message especially made sense. Consumerism served as a surrogate for freedoms residents forfeited when they agreed to live in the plutonium city, dependent on one product. By living in Richland, residents took a pass on the rights to self-government, free speech, free assembly, and an independent press. They also gave up control over their bodies as they placed their urine samples each week on the front stoop and sent their kids through whole-body scanners. As consumers, however, Richland residents won back a bit of their lost voice and power, for it was over questions of consumption that they could be the most vocal, and there's big fights about dog walking and leash laws and parking. And these issues seemed trivial, but it was really meant a great deal because it simulated for them the motions of American democracy for which these people were putting their lives on the line. And I'd say that these people in Richland were not alone. Across the post-war United States, people turned their backs on long-held American values of equal access and opportunity in order to protect their property values in federally subsidized, limited access suburban communities just off limited access national defense highways. Richland simply epitomized the post-war inequities, exclusions, and hierarchies of suburbanizing America. There are lots of Americans who are happy to give up their rights and freedoms in order to exchange them for exclusive tickets to their own version of Plutopia. Now, in the Soviet Union, leaders also used consumer prerogatives to keep their chosen citizens happy. And they created, generally across the country, zones of prosperity, and that would be like prime cities like Moscow and Leningrad, amidst greater zones of poverty, and that was the collective farm system. All the whole countryside where collective farmers were made to stay on their farms, they were not allowed to leave, and they lived in dire poverty. So if you were sitting in Azurisk and you only left it for the special resorts reserved just for plutonium workers, the idea that Khrushchev's promise that the Soviet Union would achieve communism and surpass it seemed to be realized. The Soviets had achieved communism, if only in one city, if off the map. And for many people, the consuming superiority of their lives in Azurisk spoke to them of the superiority of the Soviet Union in general and of the communist experiment. And so people really believed in the Soviet Union. They were loyal and patriotic to it in quite genuine ways. As much as you hear about dissidents in the Soviet Union, there were no dissidents in Oziorsk. In the 1970s, they took polls and they found that the young generation were even more hawkish and supportive of the nuclear establishment than their parents. In 2000, they took a vote and said, do you want to get rid of the gates and the fence around the city and the checkpoint with the guards? Overwhelmingly, they voted to keep the guards and the gates and remain in a state of sort of a gilded cage. They wanted to keep the riffraff out, they said. So in conclusion, I think the most important element to keeping the secrets of the plutonium disasters was the cultivation of these thriving consumer cultures. In both cities, blue-collar workers were paid and lived like the middle classes, and in a way that their allegiances shifted upwards towards their superiors and their bosses. By zoning territories into zones of privilege and zones of poverty, it kept alive for Soviet urbanites the myth of socialism, just as white affluent suburbs maintain the mirage of universal opportunity in American democracy. In these highly controlled zones of privilege, the space for questioning authority narrowed greatly. Now, zoning off these areas also created an epidemiological mirage that nuclear production was safe. In the plutonium cities, the exchange of political for consumer freedom led to unannounced plutonium disasters, and we've yet to really digest the environmental, genetic, and social impact of that process. So to finish up, I just want to leave you with one last photo. It was taken in Oziorsk in 2000 at a school, and it's a school play.
And the school photo features some obviously disabled children.
And I think this photo illustrates one of the major findings of geneticists working in the late 40s in the United States. And they said quite clearly that the lasting effects of radiation would be genetic mutations that would strike especially the third generation of offspring to be exposed. And I think you can see from this photo how the welfare states that created plutonium cities also produced people who became welfare cases themselves.
Professor Kate Brown. Her new book is Plutopia, Nuclear Families, Atomic Cities, and the Great Soviet and American Plutonium Disasters. That male voice we heard near the end of the talk, describing a photo, was my friend and colleague Robin Upton, producer of the show Unwelcome Guests. UnwelcomeGuests.net. Thanks to Robin for the audio recording, which I have edited and condensed a bit. Kate Brown was speaking in Washington State, in Seattle, in July of 2013. And while we're giving out web addresses, let me add our own, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. You'll find there a free archive of our shows, plus pretty pictures and whatnot. Our show comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. Illegitimi non carborundum. Try to speak the truth, and I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Ciao.